Well, we're just a few days away from the special days of Purim, and I wanted to devote this evening's shiur to matters of Purim, and specifically to take a look at Megillas Esther. We have, for a number of years, gone through the Megillah with the very beloved Perush Yosef Lekach of Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi. I think we took 10 years and we went through the Megillah. With reluctance, we move on to other pastures because it really is a very special parish. But I would like to broaden the scope of the Pirushim from Chazal and from other Mefarshim and to try and get some insight into, deeper insight, further insight into the Megillah, and we'll begin, I hope, to take a look at the first Perek together this evening. So we begin at the beginning, which is Vayehi Bimei Achashverosh. It was in the days of Achashverosh, and no sooner has the Megillah begun, there is already room for comment. Literally from the first word or the first two words. All they seem to have said is, it was in the days. I mean, that's just an introduction. And yet, the Gemara in Maseches Megillah on Daf Yud Aleph, famously states that the word Vayehi has a negative connotation. Vayehi is Lashon Tsar. This is in contrast to the word Vahaya, which is an expression of Simcha. Why is Vayehi an expression of Tsar? Well, some people associate it with the word Vai, as in Oy Vai, and Vai is actually Hebrew in that way. It's that kind of expression of distress. Reb David Tevel, the great Talmud of Reb Chaim Volozhin, explains very beautifully why Vayehi is an expression of negative and distress. Vahaya is such a positive thing. What is the word Vayehi? It's actually the word Yehi, and it's been reversed with a Vav. Yehi is the future. The Vav turns it into the past. Says Reb David Tevel, what is a distressing situation if not one that is in front of you that you'd like to put already behind you? If only you could take Yehi and turn it into Vayehi. Those are things that we don't look forward to. Those are distressing situations. And that's why Vayehi has this connotation of Tsar. The converse is true for Vahaya. Haya is the past tense. It was. Vahaya, once again, the Vav flips it into the future. It will be. Because what is a situation that has already passed that you only wish was in the future again, if not a pleasant situation? So it's very interesting how the rules of grammar and the way the Vav works also has this atmospheric connotation with how a word is introduced with Vayehi. And certainly Vayehi Bimei. That really has this very distressing connotation. And it was a Loshon Tsar. The Pnei Yoshua asks a simple question. Namely, the Tsaras haven't begun yet. I mean to say, it will be a couple of chapters until we hear from Haman. It will be Perek Gimel. His name isn't mentioned until then. And right before that time, there's a party, and there's a beauty contest, and there's all sorts of other things. And yet, we are already introducing Perek Aleph with the word Vayehi. Where's the Tsar? But the truth of the matter is, says the Pnei Yoshua, the Torah never looks at things in that way. As if to say, Tsaras don't come out of nowhere. They are bred. They are caused. And as the Gemara famously says, and we'll need to look into it a little bit deeper, Mitzvah Shem, in the coming moments, one of the main reasons why Haman's decree for extermination was allowed at least to begin was because, among other things, the Jewish people went and enjoyed themselves in Achashverosh's feast. And therefore, says Pnei Yehoshua, in intrinsic terms, in essential terms, if you ask, where is the tragedy? The tragedy is not when Haman has his decree of annihilation. That is a response to the tragedy. The tragedy is when the Jewish people go to Achashverosh's feast. Here it begins. This will set about and bring about all of the other things which will express themselves in Haman. But if you want to know where to place the Lashon Tsar, it's when the whole thing is caused by things like Achashverosh's party and the attendance of the Jewish people there. So we begin, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. It's noteworthy that the very first time Achashverosh is mentioned in the Megillah, he's not called Hamelech Achashverosh. From this point onwards, of course, he will be called either Hamelech or Hamelech Achashverosh. But that very first time, he's not introduced by saying Vayhi bimei Hamelech Achashverosh Hamolech Mehodu Vad Kush. It's much more spread out. Initially, he's just mentioned by name. And this is an indication to the tradition that we have from Chazal that Achashverosh was not a king by birth. He was not born into royalty. He began on a rather low level of society, and then he worked his way up. Either he worked his way up, he bought his way up, he killed his way up, he did something. And then he arrived on the scene. So he muscled his way really into the position of power. And this is indicated by the fact that the first time we meet him, he's not called Hamelech Achashverosh, he's called Achashverosh, because he wasn't really a king from the outset. But then the Pasuk continues, Hu Achashverosh. So even this is somewhat wordy in the sense that the Pasuk could have simply said, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh hamolech mehodu va'ad kush. The extra words, Hu Achashverosh, which now seem to be somewhat redundant. Well, Rashi, citing Chazal, have choice words to say about Hu Achashverosh. Says Rashi, Hu birish'o. It is him, Achashverosh, in his wickedness, mitchiloso ve'ad sofo, from beginning to end. Hu Achashverosh, right down the line. And what's very interesting about this Medrash and this Rashi is that it really begins a whole theme whereby the wickedness of Achashverosh is not nearly as explicit in the Megillah as that of Haman. I mean, Haman is undoubtedly, he is the villain, he is the evil one. Achashverosh, you don't find in the same way at all. And yet, we have this Masorah from Chazal, that Achashverosh he's a Rasha from beginning to end. So how come Achashverosh's wickedness doesn't get the same explicit treatment that Haman's did? And the answer, as Mefarshim point out, is very simple. Achashverosh was king. And he was king not only during the story, he was king after the story. And in the famous words of the Gemara, Akati avdi Achashverosh anan. We were still servants of Achashverosh even after the miracle of Purim occurred. The miracle is that the Jewish people survived and were not exterminated, but they continued to live in Achashverosh's dominion. And the miracle of Purim is that he was disposed well towards the Jewish people, that he wanted to change his mind and reverse the decree to destroy them. So we're still at the mercy of Achashverosh. So the last thing you want to do in celebration of the fact that Achashverosh has become well disposed towards the Jewish people is to cause him to be ill disposed towards the Jewish people. And how would you do that? By writing explicitly in print just what an evil person he was. Because one thing we should know for sure, Megillas Esther was written that year or the year later, still in Persia. One of the first people to read Megillas Esther was Ahasuerus the king. He received a leather-bound copy of Megillas Esther. And one thing we can be pretty sure is that he did not receive a copy of Megillas Esther with Rashi's commentary. And therefore, it's an amazing situation when you picture Ahasuerus reading the Megillah. It just gets better and better for him. His name features twice in the first five words. I mean, it does, as works of literature, it doesn't get more than that. And he's lapping it up. And little does he realize that the lens through which those words are written, Hu Achashverosh, is a Rasha Mitchila Va'ad Sof. So there's a lot which is hidden in Megillas Esther. And one of the things that's hidden is the truth about Ahasuerus. And therefore, all of the negative attention can be put onto Haman. Ahasuerus comes off seeming quite a likable king, perhaps easily influenced, and maybe he shouldn't drink that much, but certainly not the evil person that we know that he is. And that's that remains Teruah Shebaal Peh, hidden even from Ahasuerus as he reads the story about himself. Well, Ahasuerus has these 127 provinces, which is the extent of the Persian Empire, effectively covering the gamut of where people are. And then what happens? So far we've introduced him. Pasuk Beis, Bayamim Mahim Kesheves HaMelech Ahasuerus HaKisei Malchuso, in those days as he sits on the royal throne, Asher B'Shushan HaBira, in Shushan, the capital. Or perhaps more correctly, Shushan HaBira, Shushan of the capital. Because the name of the city is Shushan with a komatz. A komatz word, when it becomes something of, like Yod becomes Yad HaMelech, Shushan becomes Shushan HaBira. Sounds like it's the Shushan of the capital. Either way, as Rabbi Margolius points out, we will find throughout the course of the Megillah numerous references to Shushan and numerous references to Shushan HaBira. And what is the difference between those two expressions? Do we need to be reminded periodically that Shushan is the capital and then we're okay for another while? Sometimes in the very same pasuk there can be a reference to Shushan HaBira and then to Shushan. But that is why Reb Ruvah Margolius in the Sefer HaMikra V'Mesorah points out that these are actually not the same place. Shushan was the city, the broader city, but within the city of Shushan there was a royal city, like an imperial city, and that was surrounded by a wall and a moat. And indeed, Rev Margolius notes that excavations at the site that was reckoned to be the king's palace revealed the remains of a wall, the remains of a moat, and all of these things. So the broader city is Shushan. The city within a city is Shushan HaBira, the capital Shushan. And interestingly, without going into all of the instances where it's mentioned, but one that we cannot fail to mention is actually in the Gemara. Because when Mordechai goes to Esther to tell her that she needs to intercede with the king, and she says she will, but the Jewish people need to be told to fast for 3 days, Lech, go and tell all the Jewish people, Kenosis Kol Yehudim Asher B'Shushan, go and get them all together, all the Jews in Shushan. The final pasuk of Perek Dalad says, Vaya'avor Mordechai. Mordechai passed over. And he went and did everything that Esther told him to do. Vaya'avor Mordechai. And the question is, where did he pass over? Pass over from what to what? I mean, it happens to be it was on Pesach. But passing over, what is it referring to? Well, one of the explanations given in the Gemara is that he passed over a body of water. And Shmuel says in the Gemara, She'avar Arkam Adamaya, he passes over this body of water. And Shmuel didn't say, why is there water and what is the significance of him passing over it to get to the Jews of Shushan? But the point is, says Rabbi from Margolius, this bears out what we're saying. He is currently in Shushan Habira. He's talking to the queen. So as he goes then to the broader city of Shushan, he needs to pass over that body of water which separates between the two. And this, therefore, is Shushan Habira versus Shushan. Something to keep an eye on as we, or an ear out for, as we hear the Megillah. But in any case, what happens? How is the story beginning? In Pasuk Gimel, B'shnas shalosh l'malcho, osam ishtel l'chol sarav va'avadav. In the third year of his reign, he makes a party for all of his nobles, all of his officers, all of his servants, the army, chel parasu madai, v'sarei ha'medinos lefanav. It's a very, very high-level party for the nobility. The question that we are entitled to ask is why in the third year of his reign? Well, presumably, when he assumes the throne, that's the time to make the party. But he seemingly waits 3 years, or to the third year. Why does he wait? So interestingly, continuing along the theme that Ahasuerus is not royal by birth. He comes from low level stock, but he forced his way into the monarchy. So one of the Mefarshim, Rabbi Yom Tov Tzahalon of the early Acharonim, says a very interesting thing. It could be that he wasn't ready to make a party for nobility when he first assumes the throne. He doesn't know how nobility acts. He doesn't know the protocols. He might just end up disgracing himself. It takes a while to school him into how a king should behave. I mean, the things we hear about Ahasuerus, that's not hard to believe. It could be that it took a few weeks on cutlery alone. Because here is Ahasuerus, and he's become the king, but he has to learn how to act like a king. And that actually took a good long while. After 3 years, his advisors were confident that they could release him and allow him to host a party in a way that wouldn't just ruin everything and reveal the type of person that he certainly used to be and possibly still is. So that took time. But there is a Gemara. The Gemara in, again, Maseches Megillah. The end of the first parak of Maseches Megillah has a 5-page inbuilt commentary on Megillas Esther, which obviously is a an incredible treasure. And the Gemara says that the significance of the third year of his reign is that is the year that Ahasuerus made a calculation that the Jewish people will not be returning to their land. There was a notion that after 70 years, it's in the Navi Yirmiyahu, after 70 years, the Jewish people would return. But the question is, 70 years from when? Because the exile of the Jewish people from their land in the time of Nebuchadnezzar underwent various stages. So depending on where you reckon the exile to begin, you'll count 70 years from there. Others had already counted before him, but they counted too early. Belshazzar, who's already from Babel years beforehand, had thought the 70 years were up. But Ahasuerus was a little bit more patient, and he realizes that wasn't the time. He himself was too early, but he felt that the time was up, and therefore he celebrated the non-return. The Jewish people would not be returning to their land. Now, the question is, why is that of such significance to Ahasuerus? The Jewish people will be going back, they won't be going back. What's that got to do with him, and how does it fit into the way the Megillah is describing what he's doing? Specifically, Pasuk Gimel says this party took place in the third year, but Pasuk Beis says it's in those days when he was sitting on the royal throne. Is that not a contradiction? Presumably he's sitting on the royal throne from day one. But this didn't happen on day one. It happened 3 years later. So why do we have these mixed messages of the timing from Pasuk Beis to Pasuk Gimel? Was it when he sat on the throne or 3 years later? But Rashi deals with this question. as pointed out by Reb Leib Mintzberg. Rashi says, on the words, Kisheves HaMelech HaChashverosh, as he sat on the throne, Kishiniskayim Malchuso Biyodo, when his monarchy was established in his hand. That's what it means, Kisheves. The king sits on the throne when he sits secure. And that took time. How long? 3 years. What happened at the end of those 3 years? Nothing on a level of pshat. And that is why his throne was secure. Meaning, all monarchs are wary of some type of play for the throne. And certainly, if you're not born a king, if you muscled your way in, so someone might be on the way to muscle you out. Which means that it's a very uneasy early time when he assumes the throne. Will people accept him? Will it take? Will someone oust him? Will someone assassinate him? And therefore, but as we know, when after 3 years have passed, if we can borrow the halachic terminology, it's bechezkas that he's established. In other words, there's no room to celebrate the day you assume the throne, because you may throw an expensive party and then get exiled a week later. So 3 years later, finally, that's called kesheves. The king is sitting secure on the throne, and now he's able to celebrate that. But with this in mind, says Rav Mintzberg, if the party is about establishing his monarchy, so go back to the Gemara. And the Gemara says that these 3 years coincide with his calculation that the Jewish people will not be returning. Is that a contrary explanation? Is that a completely different explanation? Says Rav Mintzberg, as he so often does, the drash, what is said through the lens of drash, is an expansion of what the Pasuk is saying, al derech hapshat. What is the significance of 3 years? On a pshat level, 3 years without mishap means his throne is established. But he is seeking to rule over everyone. But there's a prophecy that the Jewish people will be going back and establishing their own rule, which is perhaps a competing monarchy as far as he's concerned. That's why it is good news for him that the Jewish people will not be returning, because now his rule is established, in his estimation, over everyone. Which means ultimately the Gemara's discussion of his understanding that the Nevuah of 70 years would not be fulfilled is yet an expansion of the idea of the establishing of his kingship. If they're not going back, they too are part of my now all-encompassing monarchy. And until you're the ruler over everyone, it's not enough if you're Achashverosh. So hence the party. But now we understand, as Rabbi Yonasan Eibeshitz points out, why it was considered such a terrible thing for the Jewish people to attend that party. As if to say, without belittling any of the other minor offenses or sins, if the food wasn't badatz, or if it wasn't mahadrin, or perhaps not even kosher, that would be very unfortunate, but that is not grounds for a decree of extermination, as this is flagged as one of the causes for that decree. It's more than that. If you understand that the party was to celebrate the end of the national aspirations of the Jewish people, then for the Jewish people themselves to attend that celebration and to participate is effectively to be celebrating their own national demise. So then a decree is coming. That's really what the level of wrongdoing in attending the feast of Achashverosh. It's for this reason that in order to make amends for that, firstly they fasted, which is the opposite of feasting. But in the end, one of the mitzvahs of Purim is Mishteh V'Yom Tov. It is to have a feast. But our feast is the opposite of Achashverosh's feast. His feast is the celebration of the end of the Jewish people. Every Purim feast is a yearly celebration of the eternity of the Jewish people, of Netzach Yisrael. That's how the Mishteh every year is an ongoing tikkun for the Mishteh of Achashverosh in terms of what it represented. At the time, however, Achashverosh was absolutely looking to assert the notion that the Jewish aspirations are over. And that is why in the first party, the Gemara says, he wore the big day kahuna. He had in his possession, which he took, he plundered from the Babylonians, the big day kahuna, which is the ultimate desecration. But here is Achashverosh saying that the greatest specimen of human being is standing right before you. It's me, Achashverosh, because don't imagine that you're going to be exposed to anything else or you'll be able to achieve anything beyond my realm. After that, after the first party, which was 180 days, right, to establish that everyone comes and gives obeisance to Achashverosh, he makes another party for the Jews in Shushan, for everyone in Shushan, or actually more correctly, for those who were Nimtza'im b'Shushan Habira, those who were found in Shushan Habira. Once again, in that royal city, anyone who frequented there, he was invited to the party. And the pasuk gives us a great description, detailed description of everything that was there. And pasuk Zion once again, vashkos bechle zahav, that the people were given to drink vechelim mikelim shonim, and there were all sorts of different kelim. And again, the Gemara says those were kelim of the Beis Hamikdash. It's for this reason that to consider being at a party celebrating with kelim of the Beis Hamikdash being used to pour wine at that party, it was asserting again that this is the end of the Jewish people. These kelim have no use for anything other than for one of Achashverosh's party. It's for this reason that there is a widespread minhag to, when laying the Megillah, to say these three words or to intone these three words in the Eicha tune, V'chelim Mikelim Shonim, because it's really a continuation of the tragedy of Eicha. Well, this is the party which goes on for 7 days, and as Pasuk Yud tells us, on day 7, Achashverosh decides to call for Vashti. Bayom Hashvi'i, Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin, as his heart was merry with wine. In other words, he's in a good mood. And this is one of the reasons why things are going to go so terribly wrong for Vashti, because not only did she disobey, she ruined everything. The Achashverosh was looking forward to this being the crowning achievement of the party, and Vashti ruined everything. By Yom HaShvi'i, the Gemara says, was actually Shabbos. And this was part of Vashti's own comeuppance, because she had girls and specifically delighted and making them work for her on Shabbos, Jewish girls, that is to say, and therefore she met her end on Shabbos itself, on Bayom HaShvi'i, says the Gemara in Megillah. And Achashverosh sends his 7 sarisim, as the pasuk lists them, Mehuman, Bizza, Chavona, Bigsa, Vavkasa, Zesa, Vecharkas. Okay, none of those names are known to us from anywhere else, with one exception, of course, and that's Charvona. He is one of these 7 sarisim. He will later feature as the one who points out the gallows on the second day of the Mishneh, which in the end Haman will be hanged upon. Interestingly, he's mentioned twice in the Megillah, here and there, but his name is actually spelled differently on both occasions. On this first occasion, his name is spelled Chavona, it ends with an Aleph. Later on, when in that second feast, his name ends with a He. And the Sheila Sutshuvas Mayim Chaim explains that this is the remez for what the Chazal say, that later on it was actually Eliyahu HaNavi who was in the guise of Chavona. Generally speaking, Aramaic or names and such like will end with an Aleph. Hebrew names tend to end with a He. And therefore, even if the pronunciation is the same. And that's why when we originally meet him, he's Chavona with an Aleph. And he's, it's just Chavona the person, the steward of the king. But later on, it's someone else. It's a higher form of Chavona. It's Eliyahu HaNavi who appropriates his body for mitzvah purposes. So they call for Vashti, and Vashti refuses. Vatema'in Hamalka Vashti, she refuses. And The Gemara actually is a bit puzzled as to why she would refuse. After all, if she really was that beautiful, why would she not want to come to Achashverosh's party? And the Gemara presents two explanations. Something happened to Vashti. The first explanation, says the Gemara, is that she got tsaras. So that changed everything. She doesn't want to appear with tsaras anywhere, and certainly not where everyone's meant to be looking and see how beautiful she is, and she has this tsaras condition. That's the first opinion. Just this past Shabbos, my grandchildren were with us for Shabbos. My oldest grandson, who's 3 years old, who's learning about the Megillah. So I asked him this question: why did Vashti not want to come to Achashverosh's feast? And he said, because she got pimples. True words. So the first opinion is that Vashti got tsaras. The second opinion is, in the words of the Gemara, Gavriel came down and attached a tail to her. Now, this is something that Mefarshim talk about. He came down and he gave her a tail. What does it mean? The Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ben Aderet, in his Chidushi Agodas, explains as follows. He seems to be less inclined to understand this Agoda Kipshuto, and we know that there exists the possibility that an Agoda is meant to communicate a message, not necessarily Kipshuto, literally. And the Rashba understands that the message is, we find in the words of the Torah and in the words of Chazal, that anything that is deficient is called a zanav, is called a tail. When the Jewish people are being predicted that they will be oppressed and they will fall behind, hu yeh l'rosh, your enemy will be the rosh, v'atah tiyeh l'zanav, and you'll be the tail. So the tail already in the words of the Chumash refers to someone who is deficient or failing. And certainly in the words of Chazal, you should be the tail to the lions and not the head to the foxes in Pirkei Avos. And we see on Rosh Hashanah, Sheniyeh l'rosh v'lo l'zanav. And therefore, the Rashba understands that when it says that a tail was attached to her, what it means is that somehow she developed, again, a condition, not tsaras, but some other thing which made her look either very unsightly and not the successful, beautiful woman that she would like to appear. She was given the tail end of the deal. She was this was her affliction. The Maharsha cites this explanation, and the Maharsha says, I'm not sure why anyone would be reluctant, or why we should be reluctant to explain the Gemara Kipshuto. Whatever the reason is, but nonetheless, if the Gemara says that Gavriel gave her a tail, so maybe gave her a tail. To what end? To make it very awkward for her and unsightly for her to appear anywhere. That may well be. This is really an ongoing, one could say, an ongoing debate, so to speak, between the Mefarshim like the Rashba and like the Maharsha as to whether these unusual agadas, are they purely to be taken as communicating a concept, or are they also kipshuto with the concept? That's the Maharsha is more inclined to take them kipshuto generally, Rashba less so. But there is a fascinating explanation of this, of the concept within attaching a tail to her, and it's to be found in the commentary of the Medrash Shmuel on Megillah. The Medrash Shmuel, Rabbi Shmuel D'Uzida from Tzfat in the 1500s, he's famous for his Perush on Pirkei Avos, Medrash Shmuel, which is an absolute classic. But he also has a commentary on Megillas Esther. And it's closer in theme, as we'll see, to the Rashba. But the Medrash Shmuel says we need to understand there is something of a power play between Achashverosh and Vashti. I mean, this we know, right? Vashti herself is from royalty. She's from the royal house of Nebuchadnezzar, a granddaughter, a great-granddaughter. Now, on the one hand, that's yesterday's monarchy, but she does have blue blood. On the other hand, Achashverosh, he's the current power, but he doesn't really have much yichus. So this is now a bit of an ongoing point of contention between them as to who's really in charge. Or could we put it slightly differently? The tension between Vashti and Achashverosh is, who is the Rosh and who is the Zanav? Who's the head and who's the tail? And therefore, there's a natural resistance to Vashti just to obey Achashverosh. He calls for her, and then maybe she might be inclined to go. But Gavriel comes and he attaches a tail to her. And what does it mean he attaches a tail to her? It means he attaches to her the stigma and the insecurity of saying, if you go to Achashverosh, then you are the tail. Then you've demonstrated that he is the head and you're the tail. And when he calls, you follow. And that is the tail that Vashti grew. It was a tail complex, so to speak. And it's for this reason that she reacted very badly to it. And the Gemara says that when she refused, she didn't just refuse, she sent back words of insult to Achashverosh. And she said to him that, I remember you when you were the stable boy in my grandfather's stables and in his palace, and you're not going to tell me what to do. So those were stinging words, but that's her reaction to the tale that was given to her. Achashverosh and since that time has come a long way. I think it's in honor of Purim, I think it's certainly fair to say that that is a summation of Achashverosh in general, far from stable. But either way, Vashti says she's not coming, and she refuses. Whether it was a literal tale, whether it wasn't a literal tale, one thing we can be sure, if Vashti thought that at this stage all of her troubles were behind her, so that was certainly not the case. Well, she refuses, and how does Achashverosh react? The Pasuk Yud Beis Vatama'ena Malka Vashti Levo B'Dvar HaMelech. She refuses. Hashem Yad HaSarisim Vayikzof HaMelech Mo'od. Achashverosh is furious. V'chamoso Bar Rabo. It's a double expression. He's furious, and his anger burns bow. And the Alshich HaKadosh explains in his Perush to the Megillah that Vayikzof HaMelech Ma'od, he's furious at her, but V'chamoso Bar Avo, he's also angry at himself. In other words, he realized that he's created a great problem for himself. If only he'd thought about it a little bit more, he would have gone about it in a different way. But now he's in a situation, it's not so easy to get out of it. So he's furious at her, but he's fuming at himself as well. Like, how did he get into this to this situation? He starts to consult all sorts of people. And in fact, according to the Gemara, the first group of people that he consults are actually the Sanhedrin. Vayomer HaMelech laChachamim Yodei HaItim. The Chachamim Yodei HaItim, there's all sorts of associations, Bina LeItim, the Yisachar and the Sanhedrin. And he figures that he will get a good answer from them. And the Gemara says the Sanhedrin did not want to get involved in this situation. It's one of those situations where whatever you say, there will be trouble, especially if you're Jewish. And they could either advise that he show clemency to Vashti or that he kill her. Either way could backfire against them the very next day, if not sooner. Because if we say to show clemency, so then we're disrespecting the king, because she has disobeyed him. So why are you pleading for clemency? But if we say to kill her, so then the king is now under the influence of wine. This time tomorrow, he'll wake up again. Where's Vashti? And it will be the Sanhedrin that killed her. So there's no right answer. And that's why what the Sanhedrin did is that they said to Achashverosh, we're very sorry. From the time we've been exiled from our land, we're unable to offer opinions on capital cases. And with that, they rather tactfully withdrew themselves from the case. And it was left to others. In the end, it was someone called Memuchan in Pasuk Tet Zion. He's the one that speaks up. We don't know what anyone else said. All we know is Memuchan is the one who really seems to take over here and discusses what should happen. Who is Memuchan? Well, the Gemara says Memuchan is Haman. Why is he called Memuchan here? In the words of the Gemara, Muchan leper onus. He is ready for disaster. Why is that being highlighted here, the fact that he's being ready for disaster? Because, as the Mefarshim point out, he is currently readying himself for disaster, because everything he's about to do will get rid of Vashti. Once Vashti has been gotten rid of, so then her place would be taken by Esther, who in the end would be the demise of Haman. So he's called Memuchan here because he, unbeknownst to him, he is currently now creating a vacancy that will be filled by the one who will be his downfall. Memuchan. But he speaks up and he has very harsh words to say about Vashti. And the Shaila is, why? Why does Memuchan, of all people, have such a hard case to be pressing against Vashti? What does he have against her? Anything personal? Says the Medrash, yes. There are three explanations given in the Medrash as to why Memuchan had it in for Vashti and took it upon him as his personal mission to see to it that she would be removed. There, and don't forget, he's mentioned last on the list of the nobles. He's the most junior of the nobles. Etiquette would require, protocol would require, that he not speak up. But speak up he does. The first explanation, says the Medrash, is that Vashti herself personally was insulting to Haman. The way that she treated him was completely without respect. She disgraced him and acted in a way that showed that she had no time for him, and she barely had time for her husband. That's Ahasuerus, and he's the king. Certainly someone like Haman, she let known her disdain for Haman, and he did not take that well at all. Once again, here's Vashti with the blue blood, here's Haman with with not too much to say for himself, and he'd had enough, and he made a move to get rid of her. He'd had enough of her insults. The second explanation, says the Medrash, is that Haman's wife had not been invited to the party. Vashti had not invited Zeresh to the party. Well, Haman's wife says, Zeresh, again, can you blame her? But nonetheless, all the noble women had been invited to Vashti's party. Zeresh had been excluded. Now, lest we think that this is Haman taking up his wife's cause, there was more to it than that. Zeresh, who had not been invited to Vashti's party, made it clear to Haman that the reason why she wasn't invited is because he wasn't important enough a personality. So this was not a good situation for Haman, and therefore, once again, he decided to get rid of Vashti. The third explanation, which is not so much a personal thing between him and Vashti, the first two are really personal, either between Vashti and him, or Vashti and his wife and him. The first two are personal. The third is more business. Says the Medrash, Haman had his own ideas as to who should be the queen. And he saw an opening. Who does Haman think should be the queen? His very own daughter. And that's why he saw that it's a shas hakosher. Vashti's in a precarious situation. He can get rid of her. And then perhaps if he carries the king favor, his own daughter will take over. The allusion to this in the pasuk is the fact that if you look in pasuk yud tes, imalamelech tov yetzei dva machus milfanav, that a royal decree go forward v'kasei b'dasei farasu madai v'lo yavor, and it should be written into the law asher lo tova Vashti lifnei amelech Achashverosh, so Vashti will be discontinued umalchusa yitein hamelech lirusa tova mimeno. And who will the crown be given to her peer or her fellow who's better than she is? So it's very interesting just to pause for a moment. They're in the middle of a case about Vashti. What should Vashti's punishment be? Whatever it should be, it should be. If she's to be removed, she's to be removed. What will happen after that will need to be discussed afterwards. But it's interesting that Haman, he almost can't wait. He can't wait to say that the Vashti should be gotten out of the way, and then her crown will be given to one who's better than her. Because that's what it's all about from the outset, as far as Hominid's concerned, because he wants the position to go to his daughter. Little did he imagine just the elaborate contest that would take place in the very next chapter, and his daughter is probably not even in part of it, but that's already too late to deal with that. So these are the three explanations in the Medrash as to why Memuchan takes this up as a personal cause to get rid of Vashti. And what exactly does he say to do with her? Well, once again, the words that we said are in Pasuk Yotes, Asher lo tavo Vashti lifnei ha-melech ha-chashverosh. Vashti shall not come before Achashverosh. What does that mean? Well, the Gemara says it means to kill her, off with her head. But it is interesting that the Pasuk doesn't actually say that Memuchan said to kill her. He just said that she shouldn't come before the king anymore. There are certain Rishonim, earlier than Rishon Rabbeinu Sajagon and a couple of others, who understand al derech hapshat that she was just removed from the situation, not necessarily killed. We could borrow a expression from our common parlance, Vashti was cancelled. She's not the queen anymore. She's not the queen. Regrettably, she's not the queen, and she never will be again. However, the Rashbam Rashi's grandson, who notes that the simple reading doesn't say that she was killed, but the Rashbam says, but if the Gemara says that she was killed, so the Gemara has a Masorah about this. Either way, the Pasuk doesn't say it openly, and perhaps even Haman couldn't bring himself to actually say those words to Achashverosh. Rather, he used the more delicate expression, Shelo Tavo Lifnei HaMelech, and V'ham Evin Yevin. And then it's understood, once she's out of the way, so she has to be taken out of the way completely. Either way, we never hear from her again. But Haman's words at the end of the pasuk, "Umalchusa yitena melech liruusa hatovah mimena," her kingship will be given to her peer or her fellow who is better than her. The Medrash says that these were very prescient words. And once again, it could be these are the words of the Megillah effectively presenting what Haman is saying, but with the Megillah's own additional message. Because it happens to be that an expression such as this was used many, many years prior in Esther's family. This is the expression with which Shaul lost the kingship. It's going to be the Haftarah for this week, for Parshas Zohar, for this week. When Shaul says that the malchus will be taken from you and will be given l'reyacha hatov mimcha, to your fellow who's better than you. And that was to David. And the Medrash notes this. The very same expression with which the malchus was taken from Shaul, malchus was restored to his descendant, to Esther. U'malchusa yitena melech lirusa hatova mimena. And as Mefarshim point out, Yoshua Bachrach in the Sefer Kisvuni Ladoros. What the notion here is that Esther returning to kingship is able to rectify the mistake that was the reason that Shaul lost the kingship in the first place. As we know, again, it's the Haftarah from this week's parasha for Zohar. He was meant to destroy everyone in Amalek, but he didn't. He had Rachmanus on the king and various other things, and with the best of intentions, he's Shaul. We can't comment on the Shaul, but nonetheless, Shmuel says that wasn't the to second guess the command is made him ineligible for Malchus, and Amalek persisted. So his descendant reassumes the mantle of royalty in order to finish, or at least the extent that she could, the business that had been left unfinished by Shaul. And that you have that phrase, that motif phrase, that really links the loss of Malchus, the removal of Malchus from Shaul, and the restoration of Malchus from Esther. Either way, Achashverosh likes Haman's idea, and they send out these messages. The final pasuk kafbeis, Vayishlach Sfarim al kol medinos hamelach, because after all, what Haman had said to Ahasuerus is that Vashti has terribly disrespected you. That will lead to a precedent, and when word gets out, and all the husbands will be a laughing stock, and no one will be respected, and it'll be absolute mayhem, and it will be a bizayon for the men, and they will be angry at you. Ukedai bizayon vaketzef. There will be a lot of bizayon for the men, and ketzef, that will then lead them to be angry at you, and therefore this matter needs to be put right, which they do. As Vayishlach Svarim al Kol Medinos HaMelech al Medina al Medina Kirsava Bel Amva Am Kirshano, right, each place, each locale, Liot Kol Ish Sareh Beveso Umedaber Kirshon Am, that each person, he will be the lord in his house, and he speaks the language that is his own native language. That's how the Perek ends. And here too, the Gemara says there was a good dose of Hashkocha, in the sense that this was the first message that went out from Ahasuerus, the first batch of letters that went out everywhere. And what's the message? Every man is in charge of his house, and he should speak the language, he should speak his native language. Now, as far as Ahasuerus was concerned, this was a very, very significant message. As far as everyone else was concerned, it was a ridiculous message, because that's basically what everyone had been doing until that point. So they receive with all the pomp and circumstance of a royal decree something which actually doesn't make any sense. And people began to doubt the cerebral cogency of Ahasuerus's decisions, because he made a whole production out of sending out a message to tell people to speak their own language. What this did is it made people rather suspect of just how seriously to take letters of Ahasuerus. Why is this important? Because a short while later, or whenever it was, actually a number of years later, 9 years after the Suuda, would be the decrees of Haman, but a similar letter would go out. And the letter says, everyone is to be ready to destroy the Jewish people absolutely on this first. But people remember it. We've had a letter from him before. The first one didn't make any sense at all. Now here's the second one. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And what that means is, although people were prepared to see what would happen, no one jumped the gun. There were 11 months between the sending out of the letters, those first letters, and Purim. It was only a couple of months later they were rescinded. But in other words, there's always the notion that if you tell people in 11 months' time the Jewish people are fair game, well, maybe it's reason makdimim. Okay, some people might not wait that long, and they will assume that they will have the sanction of the law, whatever they do to the Jewish people. But no one did that. No one made a move on the Jewish people, certainly not independently, because they didn't know whether they could trust this letter. Thanks to what? Thanks to the first letters that came out. The first letters didn't make any sense at all. And therefore, time was allowed to elapse until the whole thing came out and the Jewish people were, that decree was rescinded as well. And what does all of this mean? Having looked at some of the psukim, having received the insights from Chazal and from the Mefarshim to give us a deeper experiential sense of the events of the first party and the themes at play. But what is the overarching theme, or more correctly, the underlying theme, as presented by the Al-Sheikh? To see how we began with the words Vayehi Bimei. This party is a scene of tragedy. Haman is not the tragedy. Haman is a tool to respond to that tragedy. I mean, no credit for Haman. But the tragedy begins when the Jewish people attend Ahasuerus' feast and enjoy themselves there with everything that it represents. That's the Loshon Tsar. So the center of tragedy is that party. And the Jewish people are getting themselves further and further into trouble. And yet, it is at that very party, when the Jewish people are, so to speak, incurring the wrath of Hashem by enjoying the end of the Jewish people and participating in a Suuda where the Kelim of the Beis HaMikdash are used, etc., etc. Now they will have to deal with that. But the wherewithal with which they'll be able to deal with it is actually being prepared by Hashem at the very same Mishteh. That means concurrently and simultaneously to the Jewish people getting themselves, digging themselves deeper and deeper into trouble, is Hashem already preparing the vacancy for the one who will save them when the time comes. That is the concept of Makdim Refua Lamaka, because Hashem's goal is never to destroy the Jewish people, but they need to be reawakened. And if they get themselves into trouble, or if they themselves are in danger of disintegrating or dissolving or just disappearing just through their own apathy, so then something needs to be done. And it's a jolt, and it will be something of a rude awakening for them. but the result will be that they're awake and not just fall into some dormant state and then disappear forever. So we see it's very tightly wound, this Mishteh of Ahasuerus. So many things are going on. The Jewish people are making things worse and worse for themselves. Hashem is preparing things for them to become better and better when the time comes. It's all happening at the same time. And needless to say, anyone at the party in real time would have no idea whatsoever of any of this. That is to say, not only would they have no notion of how much trouble they're getting themselves into, they certainly could never have imagined that this is already the beginnings of the Geula and Yeshua when the time comes. Nistarim Darchi Hashem, the way Hashem maneuvers, interacts with people's own decisions, is something that's beyond that. For much of the Purim story, most of what was happening was not really readily understandable for the Jewish people. It only really came out at the end, when all was revealed. At that point, we'd like to think that we understand perhaps more than we do. We'd certainly like to understand more than we do. But events as they are, certainly in the same way that with the message of Purim is Netzach Yisrael, the eternity of the Jewish people against their foes and those who would seek their demise. And we say Teshuah Soma Yisrael Netzach. The Teshuah is an eternal Teshuah. That v'tikvasim b'chol davador, it gives hope for every generation, because the Jewish people were never closer to absolutely ending than in the time of Purim. But Hashem has showed how much He will do in order to ensure that that will never happen. And therefore, the celebration of Purim is a celebration of Netzach Yisrael. And even though there's a lot in the current matzav which is not worth celebrating, but Netzach Yisrael is yes worth celebrating. And if we connect with the core themes, that itself should be a schus and a decisive step to lead us out once again towards Ora, b'simcha, b'sasim, b'yikar, kein t'yalan. I wish you all a very lecha Purim. We should all have a seros tovas, leklal uleprat. And we'll meet again in Mirtz Hashem in 2 weeks' time. This time next week will be, I'm not exactly sure in advance how to describe what it will be, but it will be Monday evening, Motse Suda. So we'll meet again, Mitz Hashem, in 2 weeks. All the very best for the Purim.